Okay. Well, thanks, guys. I'm going to pop it ahead of time. I'm covering labor and delivery right now, and I really hope nothing pulls me away from here. So if I just abruptly leave, someone can take over. But what I wanted to talk about and what I've learned is from getting some feedback from some of you guys by email and by phone, which I always welcome, and this admission as we've kind of gone through working through some of these things that we thought we were just totally ready and able to do, and we've come across a couple of small little barriers and some interesting tidbits that have come along that I thought would sort of be interesting to share as far as just some of the challenges that preeclampsia has in general, and then to try to do a quality improvement project on an unpredictable, wide-spectrum disease does lend itself to difficulty. So I want to take a little bit of time. I don't think I'm going to use the whole time. I want to take the more time we kind of talk and interact, the better, but hopefully I can spur on some questions and some thoughts and hopefully some answers from this. Hey, Tim, am I able to, like, advance these or not?
No, if you'll just tell me when you're ready.
Okay, cool. So what we're going to do, if I, you know, I had one of my old mentors said, you know, you can do three things in 3 minutes, you've done great. Well, we're going to try to do three things in more than 3 minutes, but help, if nothing else, if you have some better idea of how to develop and identify the subjective symptoms of severe disease of preeclampsia, that'd be great. And I've had a, you know, we'll talk about it a little bit. You know, I had a week on service on labor and delivery at a referral hospital, like many of you guys have, where we were just totally challenged by subjective symptoms, and they were really severe symptoms, or were they not? And I think that becomes really important when you're trying to gauge potentially a symptom that regards delivery at 33 weeks on somebody, and then how well can you really fish those things out. Talk a little bit more about blood pressure measurement. This is not where I thought a lot of this discussion would go. And when we had our annual meeting, we talked a lot about blood pressure monitoring and blood pressure measurement. And then once again, when I was talking to the residents today, we were actually talking about blood pressure measurements, you know, and how we really know how blood pressure measurement is really being done accurately to make a diagnosis. And I think that's going to become an exciting part of this for a lot of places. The more questions you ask, you don't always like the answers. And then lastly, to identify strategies to help you guys help categorize women with hypertension in pregnancy. It's not always straightforward. We get that. I know for sure that Mission's going to have an outlier because one of our MFMs called someone atypical health. I have no idea what atypical health meant. This woman should have been delivered. I don't doubt that. It's not going to categorize very easily when I have to put it into a category. And that's kind of part of what preeclampsia is. So I think we have to recognize there are going to be people who fall out because, you know, we're dealing with a complex disease. I think it's best we can categorize people and the best we can use definitions and then teach these new definitions to people, I think, becomes pretty critical. So next slide, please, Tammy. So like I said, common things happen. So I was on night float last week. It's, you know, 5 14-hour night shifts at Mission Hospital, which is always a lot of fun. It's more L&D than I like to do in a week, to be perfectly blunt. But my last shift of my night float week, which was last Thursday, we had 2 antepartum patients, 33 weeks with superimposed preeclampsia, who's still pregnant, by the way, and a 30-weeker who were ruling out for pre-E, who's a longtime diabetic and is challenging. And we had 3 postpartum patients, this atypical health woman who delivered at 32 weeks with twins. We had a lady that had chronic hypertension and failed her contraction stress test who we delivered. And then we had a lady that we just delivered that was a 17-year-old with severe features who delivered at 33 weeks. So this is not an uncommon problem. I know I'm preaching to the choir here, but, you know, preeclampsia is a, you know, it's challenging to work with, but it's something that's very common. This is just one snapshot at one hospital, and your hospitals are probably very, very similar. Next slide. So once again, just for to be on the same page, you know, these are the severe features of preeclampsia by the new ACOG guidelines. We still have our blood pressure guidelines, which are 160 over 110, thrombocytopenia, platelets less than 100,000, impaired liver function either based on LFTs or based on what they call severe persistent right upper quadrant or epigastric pain, progressive renal insufficiency, pulmonary edema, or new onset cerebral or visual disturbances. So these are the things we're looking for severe features. And sometimes they're obvious. Blood pressure, assuming you're measuring it appropriately, it's not a tough one. Thrombocytopenia, it's a number. You know, it's a line in the sand, but it's a number. But some of these get more subjective. Next slide. So how does ACOG guide us? And we talked a little bit about this at the annual meeting, really start thinking more about it and trying to find any sort of consistency among my colleagues. You know, what is right upper quadrant, you know, or epigastric pain? And they try to give us some help with this. And I think as you guys at each of your institutions try to find kind of a way to work through this and a kind of way to standardize it as best you can, there are legitimate questions. You know, what is severe and persistent? What is unresponsive to medication? What is not accounted by alternative diagnoses? Since gallbladder disease is so incredibly common, especially in pregnant women. Then cerebral visual disturbances. The only guidance we have is it has to be new onset and persistent. So, you know, sometimes that's clear, but sometimes we have patients that have known migraines. We had a patient recently who we were really about to call someone a severe persistent headache, and someone actually talked to them more and goes, no, this is the exact headache I get when I have my sinuses. I haven't taken my Zyrtec in 3 days. I'm really congested. This is what happened. And we gave her Zyrtec back, and, you know, she felt better. So it does get tricky. You know, it's the obvious ones are obvious, but the tricky ones are tricky. Next slide. So I don't have the answer to this, but I think, you know, as we at Mission, because we're involved in this just like you guys are, as we're trying to kind of come up with a process or a way to discuss this with people, you know, what am I thinking about, or, and what may you want to be thinking about when you have right upper quadrant epigastric pain, and knowing that I have a lot of maternal fetal medicine specialists on the phone who know this as well, if not better than I do, you got to think about other things. Do they have reflux? So, I mean, there are some places that, you know, if you're not sure if the epigastric pain is really that true, you know, persistent, non-relenting pain, some people try a GI cocktail or try an antacid to see, because reflux is really common in pregnancy, and you don't want to mistake that as a severe symptom. Gallbladder disease, we mentioned before, very, very common. Does that mean you have to get ultrasounds in everybody? No, but a good history can sometimes tell you, you know, when is this pain happening? Is it when you eat? Is it when I eat fatty foods? Has it been getting worse? Is it long-standing? You know, really, you know, it's more than just saying, oh, you meet this little criteria on a checklist. You do want to ask a little bit about it. Gas pains. I mean, some of the worst pains we've seen in women, you know, as soon as they pass gas, oh, my pain's all better. So probably not severe preeclampsia. But once again, you got to consider those things. The thing that we worry about the most is liver capsular swelling. And, I mean, I'm going to knock on wood right now, but I have not seen a liver rupture. Many of you may have. I've heard stories from Dr. Sabai, who was my chairman for a while. He had great stories about liver ruptures. That's what we worry about, but that's not always the most common thing. But once again, when you see one of those, I think that pretty much jades you for the rest of your career. So as you think through this, and I don't have the answers, I just have more questions, you know, is it reasonable when people have an uncertain history and this subjective symptom is unclear, is it reasonable to give a GI cocktail to see if it's discovered? Or give them a PPI, or you have to be patient. You have to kind of see where things go, and rather than just, hey, you have right upper quadrant pain, and you have some high blood pressures, and, you know, you've gone from without severe features to severe features, you know, I just want to, you know, give it a little bit of time, see what happens before I call someone severely or preeclamptic with severe features and move to delivery. Next slide. Same thing with the cerebral and visual disturbances. I think sometimes those are even more difficult. Because there's so many, just like there's so many reasons that you can have right upper quadrant epigastric pain, there are a ton of reasons why you can have a headache. I mean, you can have a tension headache. You can actually have a true migraine headache. I mean, honestly, that's how my wife, when she presented in labor, they thought she was severely preeclamptic because she had a blaring headache and visual field disturbances, but she has migraines, and it wound up just being one of her migraines. But, I mean, that's a history you have to get out, and that's, you know, something you have to sort of realize and, you know, that takes a discussion with the patient. This is like your typical migraine. What are your triggers? You know, obviously, hypertensive crisis is something you're going to see. I mean, people with high blood pressures have headaches. That could be a potential medical emergency. So that's, there's some very innocuous things in the diagnosis. There's some obviously more concerning things. Subarachnoid hemorrhage. I mean, that would, you know, someone, you know, truly blows a vessel. That is bad. And we're all trying to prevent that. And that's why we're being so, you know, good about early recognition and making sure we're managing blood pressures appropriately. But, you know, the range of the differential goes from something relatively mild, something that's pretty scary and pretty dangerous. So it does make it a little bit more difficult for us, and we want to find that balance as providers and as clinicians. So, you know, the question is, what are the reasonable interventions when you have, especially the headache? I mean, I think Tylenol, I think, probably thinks is an okay thing to give, but, you know, we do a lot of Fiorcet out here, which was a new thing to me when I first came out to Western North Carolina. And Furoset is not the greatest migraine medicine in general because of the risk of rebound headaches. But once again, you know, I don't think a truly severe preeclamptic feature headache gets better with Furoset necessarily. And then there are a lot of people that I know that give narcotics, and I mean, narcotics will fix almost any headache. So, you know, if you have a headache that truly needs narcotics, is that really that severe, unrelenting headache? I don't know, but I think these are the questions you need to ask, and these are sort of the approach you have to get as you try to get providers and, you know, nurses and everybody taking care of this patient to know what is normal, what is not normal, what do we have to worry about, what do we not have to worry about. And I think the more we all do this, and I can speak mostly for myself, these subjective symptoms, I mean, there are times that really make me pause because I just don't know. Well, that is a headache because she's having a headache, or is she having one that's truly cerebral edema, preeclamptic kind of headache? Next slide. So the good news is you raise these questions, and I think you always try to be positive, although I've been told I'm a pessimist by nature, probably because I'm a New Yorker. The truth is that there's always an opportunity to improve something. So I think, once again, these subjective symptoms do lend themselves to an opportunity for quality improvement. And it's really trying to come up with an institutional approach to how you evaluate these subjective symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
What is a severe headache? What is unremitting right upper quadrant pain? What interventions are reasonable to flush out the severe headache versus not? And I think that, as you guys work through your all the things that we're asking you to do, but if you're really looking at how to improve, you know, quality, we want to make sure that, you know, just like we're going to talk in a second, how blood pressure is measured accurately, how do you assess a subjective symptom? I'm not saying that's simple, but I think to have a consistency, or at least have a general approach, would be something from a quality improvement standpoint would be really quite valuable. So I'm going to think about it, and we can, you know, if you have any ideas and thoughts, we'll kind of save questions to the end, but definitely something to think about. Next slide, please, Tammy. Now let's talk about blood pressure. So I show this slide for a couple reasons. One is, you know, you have on your left your typical, the way you think about measuring blood pressure, how I learned in physical diagnosis class, and think of manometer that we use. And then on the right, you have what one of my MFMs called today, the nurse on a stick, where she goes, I don't trust that blood pressure measurement ever. And that's just her opinion. But it does lend to a good discussion about blood pressure. And I'm going to tell you some quotes in a second that I bet you all have heard. And as we get into more of the discussion standpoint, I'd be really interested to see how you guys have dealt with it. Next slide, please. So you've all heard this, okay? I had a high blood pressure on the machine, so I did a manual blood pressure, which is sort of a value judgment that one's better than the other. And I'm not saying one is better than the other, but I've heard this from a million nurses that I didn't trust the machine, so I did a manual one. Well, if you don't do manual ones on everybody, how do you know you're really getting the right blood pressure? Or, hey, you know, she had an elevated blood pressure. She just walked up the stairs. She just had a cigarette. Take her blood pressure again later. If it's normal, you're fine. Well, the question is, which blood pressure was really the abnormal blood pressure? Was it the one? Yeah. Blood pressures are labile. They're not fixed. You know, which one do you trust? And then, you know, my favorite one is that blood pressure doesn't count. I don't know how it doesn't count. They're charting it because she was nervous or had a contraction or just had a cigarette or whatever. So we know there's a sort of an inconsistency. I mean, how do you measure blood pressures in labor? You know, women are contracting early labor. How much does pain play a role in blood pressure monitoring? So these are all things we've heard, but then when you really start looking from a quality model, and especially when you're looking at clinical decisions, delivery versus non-delivery, getting a medication to lower blood pressure or not, you know, you really want to think that this measurement is as accurate as it can be, because nothing ever is 100% accurate in life, but it'll be as close as you can get. So next slide. So, you know, I can't say before I got involved in CMOP that I really looked at this very carefully, but I dug a little bit deeper into the ACOG guidelines and looked to see how they suggest measuring blood pressure. And once again, we actually talked about this at rounds today. You know, is this possible? Can we actually do this in our office if we chose to do it? And I think we could, but it would be definitely a departure from normal. So you guys can read the slide, but I'll just say it out loud because it makes me chuckle because I know it's rarely happening, at least in my experience at multiple different institutions. The optimal blood pressure per ACOG is the patient comfortably seated, if that's possible and you're pregnant, legs uncrossed, middle of blood pressure cuff on upper arm at the level of the right atrium. Patient should relax and not talk. And ideally, this is my favorite one, 5 minutes should pass before the first blood pressure measurement is taken. Once again, I have no doubt this is the right way to do it or the optimal way to do it. I shouldn't say right, but the optimal way to do it. Just like the optimal way to do your chlamydia endocervical swab is to leave that swab in there for 30 seconds, which I know I have never done, and I've gotten plenty of positive chlamydias back in my career. So there's always a balance between what is optimal and what may be practical, and that's, you know, that's where it always gets difficult. So next slide. So what do we actually do? You know, blood pressure is taken on the upper arm when the patient in the left lateral position can falsely lower blood pressure, and that happens all the time in labor and delivery. You know, we put patients on their side, they're being monitored, you know, we're taking the upper arm. I mean, so ACOG tells us this is not a good way to measure blood pressure, yet that's probably what's done the majority of the time, especially in laboring patients. And they say this approach should be discouraged. I don't know how to discourage it and be practical, but I think it does lend itself to being aware of it and how do you institutionally approach that. Next slide. So when I started looking more at blood pressure, thanks to Elliot Main and his group in California, who I love to borrow very freely from, it could be called stealing too, but I'll give them credit at the bottom. They talk about when you take a blood pressure, it's like any other procedure, there's an approach to it. And they talk about how you have to prepare the equipment, how you prepare the patient, take the measurement, and then how you record the measurement. And I think the recording the measurement is actually a fascinating one to me, because if a nurse knows that a blood pressure measurement isn't accurate, do they have to put it in the chart? Because it's erroneous. And, you know, she may know that, but how do you tell that to the rest of the world who's looking at that same chart? So next slide. So one is preparing the equipment, and one is sort of the obvious thing that we talk about a lot, or I've talked about a lot in the course of my career, is the right cuff size. Obviously, our women who we take care of come in all different shapes and sizes, and the key thing for measuring blood pressure correctly is using the right equipment. I'm not even talking about manual versus automatic. I'm talking about having the right cuff. And this is the recommendation for having the proper cuff, and I imagine or I hope that this is sort of the practice in your hospitals, and if it's consistent, even more power to you, because I don't know how that's true in most places, but it might be. But the width of the bladder is 40% of the circumference and should encircle 80% of the arm. That's how they tell it. And actually, this is right from the CQMC, the CMQCC document. They actually tell you, this is your arm circumference, this is the right cuff size. So right cuff, really important. So, I would imagine most units out there need to have all four cuff sizes. You're going to have, you know, your skinny, you know, we're no different than any other hospital. We had a woman who just delivered who was 4'2", very thin, very, very small. We had to use a different cuff, and we had a lady with a BMI of 72 who got delivered 8 days ago who clearly needed a bigger cuff. And we have to be prepared to take care of all of those blood pressure measurements in the office and also in the hospital. Next slide. And taking the measurement, this is what, you know, the California Collaborative basically echoes ACOG. They talk about supporting the patient's arm at heart level, seated in semi-Fowler's, and tell the patient not to talk. At least one additional reading should be taken within 15 minutes and use the highest reading, not the lowest reading. Do not reposition the patient to either side to obtain a lower blood pressure. Once again, they're coming up with a consistency. And I think they're modeled out there. The question is, if this is important, how do we operationalize, you know, what are kind of developing as best practices, or at least suggested practices, if not best practices. Next slide. So once again, another opportunity for quality improvement is, you know, do you have or can you develop a standard process how to measure and document blood pressure at your institution? We talked about this a lot at the annual meeting a couple weeks ago. You know, what is the utility, if any, of a cycled unmonitored blood pressure measurement when you have no idea what position the patient is in? Are they talking? Are they yelling? Are they lying on their cuff? These cuffs are going off automatically. The data is entering automatically into your EHR, your hospital system, and we don't know how the quality of that measurement is. Our blood pressure that the nurse knows is not accurately measured included in the chart. And there are times they know, hey, that cuff wasn't on the right way. She was lying on her cuff. Something was, you know, is there a way to delete those that are automatically entered so the poor provider who's looking from home isn't freaking out about a blood pressure they know is erroneous? And then the big question that I love, I can't wait till we have discussion, is how should we properly monitor blood pressure on laboring patients? Are we going to get them to sit up in semi-Fowlers, not do anything for 15 minutes? I mean, you know, there may have to be different processes for different, you know, situations. But, I mean, that's, you know, once again, coming up with that process in your institution, you know, and basically how to operationalize to do this so it's not onerous, but it's also getting good measurement, that's a challenge. And that's, you know, if you like quality improvement, that's the fun of it. If you don't, that's why you don't like it. So but hopefully we'll have more discussion about this and think of your ideas when we open things up to questions in a little bit. Next slide. So here's a case study, and this is sort of kind of wrapping things up a little bit, because I do want to have more discussion and less didactic, if that's the appropriate term. So here, this is a patient that I took care of last week with my team at Mission. She's a 17-year-old who presented to her local health center to establish prenatal care. She was found to be 32 weeks when she came to her Indian Health Service clinic, and her blood pressure was 185 over 114. She was given labetalol because they freaked out at the Indian Health Service area, sent her to her local level 1 hospital for evaluation because that's the closest hospital in rural North Carolina. There, her blood pressure was 175 over 112. She's given hydralazine, and we got a phone call pretty quickly at Mission saying, hey, we have someone you need to take care of. Next slide. She got transferred to us where she was already on magnesium, actually. They put her on mag and gave her a shot of corticosteroids before she left the hospital there. But we kept her on the mag for 48 hours. We let her finish her course of steroids. Her blood pressure actually did much better. We didn't get a lot of high blood pressures with us. You know, we had an occasional 105 diastolic, an occasional 160 systolic. But overall, you know, she had a normally grown baby. She had, it also looked pretty good. Her AST and platelets were normal. She had no severe symptoms. And then her 24-hour urine comes back at 3,700 milligrams just because we wanted to kind of shore up the diagnosis because we had literally no past history on the 17-year-old otherwise, what we assumed healthy girl. So next question, or the next part of it. Her blood pressure then acutely worsened on the third hospital day. She was having blood pressure again in the 170s over 110s persistently. And she was done with her steroid course, and she was not responding very well to the previously given IV medications. So 3 hours later, she had the world's quickest induction, a Foley bold induction delivered 3 hours later, delivered a male infant that was 1880 grams, newborns on the NICU actually doing really, 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 really well. So the question is, next slide, she will be one of our data points in CMOP. So the question is, what category of hypertension does she have? Does she have chronic hypertension, gestational hypertension, superimposed preeclampsia? What do you guys think? That's sort of that. I mean, we called her preeclampsia severe features. Our residents did kind of do the above and beyond and actually got in touch with this girl's pediatrician and actually said, has she ever had high blood pressure? Which I doubt she did. She was a very thin, you know, otherwise healthy-looking 17-year-old. But, you know, they actually basically ruled out chronic hypertension as best you can when someone presents at 32 to prenatal care. So we categorized her with a little bit of homework as hypertension, you know, preeclampsia with severe features. And then the question we always ask ourselves is, what are opportunities for improvement in this patient's care? You know, in some ways the outcome is, you know, is not bad. I mean, she delivered 33 weeks, she has an 800-gram baby, who'll be in the nursery for a little bit. I'm not sure this could be prevented, but, you know, was there communication things we could have done better? I think that's always something that we look at and kind of hope for. You know, I think the fact she got through 48 hours of steroids was the big thing. You know, then the question is, you sort of eke out trying to get a couple more days in her. You know, those are always fair questions to ask, but, you know, we always struggle with that as clinicians of what to do in those standpoints. So next slide. There may not be a next slide if I remember. Yeah, this is, so But as we open things up to questions and this discussion, which I think is the healthiest part of these webinars and these calls, we have 20 sites. I think we're actually, do we have a 21st one now yet, Tammy, officially?
We do.
Yeah, we have 21 sites involved in this. You know, we have a decent geographic spread, although Charlotte kind of dominates, the Charlotte area sort of dominates, which is, and we'll take everybody. So, you know, I think having, you know, you see the names of the sites that are involved. I mean, you know, I just want to thank you guys for, you know, doing something that is obviously voluntary, but I think we, as we work through this and as we learn more about the hypertensive disease and what we're actually delivering our patients for and how we're trying to standardize care, I think we're really going to improve the care of mothers and infants in North Carolina, which is, you know, PCNIC's goal, and obviously all our goals as providers and people who are involved in quality improvement in healthcare. So I do thank you for being involved with this, and, you know, with, you know, engagement, us engaging you is critical, and you feeling free to ask us questions and things that make sense, don't make sense, you know, the door is always open. Just call me, email me, you know, carrier pigeon with the snow coming up here. We might be frozen out for a while. The 4 inches are coming, and it's scaring the heck out of people out here. It's pretty funny. But with that, I will just, unless Tammy has anything else to add from a nuts and bolts standpoint, open up to questions regarding this or anything else you guys have been having issues with. As we, you know, are 11 days into this project.